Sip Podcast. Wanna know what's happening to Steve? Sip Podcast. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach? Grierson and Leach. Grierson and Leach. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leach?
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leach, and this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode 179. Grierson, it's always hard in these banter things not to just talk about the horrible thing that's happening in the world that day.
It's always the same, isn't it? It's always mostly the same horrible thing.
If the question is always one of degree, right? Like is this one, why is this day any different than any other? Well, this one is how bad it gets, right? And I don't know, Chris, I was in St. Louis this weekend. And with my son, William, we take a yearly trip to Busch Stadium, saw the Cardinals split two games with Arizona, and I was wearing my Bob Gibson jersey. Shout out to Bob Gibson, who's fighting pancreatic cancer right now, one of my favorite baseball players of all time, and definitely, as I mentioned on Twitter, the coolest person I've ever been able to meet in person. And other than Grierson, of course, just to be clear.
To be second behind Bob Gibson, I'll gladly take.
Yes. So anyway, the point is that I turn around and it's hard, right? Because again, the president does shitty things all the time. I do feel, and we're always looking for thresholds. And I feel like the president is accused of rape threshold bad. President goes on Twitter and tells Congress people who are not white to go back to their home countries. This feels like, I mean, maybe there is no line anymore. Maybe there isn't. If these things aren't the line, there is no line. This feels like one of those things. If nobody gets freaked out about this, there is no line.
Yeah, because the only feasible explanation / justification is, well, you see, he's not really racist. He is just mentally deranged.
Yeah, right.
I don't find that to be a more comforting. And listen, in some ways, if that's to absolve you of feeling bad for the person that you voted for and supported for the last several years, if you want to say that he's mentally deranged, I will grant you that. It would seem a person in that position should not be in that position.
Yeah, not better. Not better. Okay, let's talk about happier things, Grierson. This is the Grierson Leach Podcast. We're going to have a happy, positive episode, right? Because all of these movies are very uplifting.
Oh, they're all fantastic, too.
Yes. this is the Grierson Leach Podcast, episode, what are we on, 179. Remind you, as always, to follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Follow us on Facebook, also Instagram. Honestly, just follow us on Facebook and Instagram. Twitter's just making it. It's just, I say this all the time, but boy, howdy, is Twitter making this bad. Here's something happy, Grierson. So someone pointed out, Letterman's not on anymore, and sometimes I get sad. I know I watch the Netflix show, but it's not the same. And I like it, but it's not the same. And someone was pointing out, one of my favorite things that Letterman ever did was when he would say, an opening in select cities this week, and God bless you, fingers crossed, if your city is one of those selected.
Yes, I will still reference that in Los Angeles in terms of movies opening in select cities. And it's always fun to see who knows what the hell I'm talking about when I make that reference.
Old people know. Anyway, follow us on something other than Twitter because it's just a bad place. You always know I've made it big, Grierson, if I'm either off Twitter or I've made someone run it for me. Anyway, GriersonLeach.com. That's our website. I'm really shaken by the events of today.
Thank God the Cardinals won today, for crying out loud. We're recording this on Sunday, obviously, as people
can. It's like a game out of wild card. It's crazy. Anyway, go to GriersonLeach.com. Go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP. See the list of every single movie we've talked about on this podcast. Just an exhausted
cable. The balloon is running out of air over there. See, what you needed to do this weekend, buddy, is this thing that I did. I'm just going to plug this really fast. I saw the new Hannah Gadsby show, and it's fabulous.
Oh, yeah.
That was the thing that kept me going this entire weekend. Douglas is terrific. He's going to be coming to New York later this summer. It'll be on Netflix next year. It's wonderful.
Okay. I thought you were going to say cocaine, so that's better.
Oh, wait, and cocaine.
Yes, that's cocaine. Anyway, email us, GersonLeach@gmail.com. Thank you, by the way, to everyone. We're going to get to this in a moment. We get a lot of really good suggestions of things we should do instead of Stuber. So we'll get to those in a moment. But thank you for, I loved all of those emails we got. That was awesome. We have a t-shirt. Gerson, where can people get the t-shirt?
Oh, cottonbureau.com.
See, you still got the energy for that. Must be the cocaine.
Yeah, and the porking. And the porking. See, I wore the shirt all week. I've been porking up a storm.
That's what I need to know. Opening, I thought this week was bad enough already. Now I got that in my head.
Yes, yes.
Opening songs from Dylan Mayer on Cuthbert Avenue. Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Close with My Friend Mary, Short Songs of Melancholy Longings, Facebook page of My Friend Mary. Hey, you should subscribe to it. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every new podcast, the second it goes up, is subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and iTunes. While you're there on iTunes, give us a review, 5 stars, please, and we will and the name of a movie you'd like to discuss, we will discuss it in our reboot section. So we have a reboot movie this week. It comes to us from Auntie Bam on August 8th, 2018. Very great listen. 5 stars, says Auntie Bam. Catchy theme song. Thoughtful reviews. But my 82-year-old, I assume there's a word missing, because this just says my 82-year-old thinks, as opposed to my 82-year-old whatever that, I don't know, maybe it's the anti-BAM of the letter, or maybe this person just has an 82-year-old that they have taken possession of in their home. But my 82-year-old thinks the leech is Lee, because in her language, it is. Please talk about a film that wrecks me, poetry. So we will be discussing poetry in our reboot section. However, we have one movie that we've both seen that we're going to discuss. And then the way we got around the Stuber problem is I just didn't see it.
It wasn't we, it was you, wasn't it?
Yeah,
like,
I had
seen Stuber by this point, and you're like, I don't think I'm going to see it. You just abdicated any sort of responsibility for the podcast. By the way,
I have
to point this out. The person who requested poetry, that was a week before Burning came out. Which is really interesting. Okay. It was October something, 2018, you said? Burning came out like August. October 26th. So this person was clearly on our wavelength and thinking about Lee Chang Dong.
We will be discussing Lee Chang Dong's movie. But I've replaced, instead of saying Stuber, I saw a movie about killer alligators. So I saw Crawl. So what we're going to do is I'm going to ask Grierson about Stuber because he took the bullet on that one. And then he's going to ask me about Crawl. So we'll keep that tight and short because, you know, this podcast is known for its brevity and conciseness. All right, Grierson, so now we're going to talk about our first new movie, the one that we've both seen. That movie is The Farewell.
What's wrong, Dad? Please tell me.
Manette is dying.
She doesn't know, so you can't say anything. The family thinks it's better not to tell her.
Why is that better? Chinese people have saying, when people get cancer, they die.
The Farewell is written and directed by Lulu Wang and stars Awkwafina, who I liked very much in both Crazy Rich Asians and in Oceans. How many oceans were there? Eight?
It was eight, right?
Yeah, she was one of the oceans. Yeah, I know. She was one of the eight oceans. She stars as Billy. Billy is from a Chinese family, but she lives in America. Her parents live in America, but her grandmother lives back in China. And her parents tell her that it turns out that her grandmother is dying. She has, we meet the grandmother, played by Zhao Shuzhen, that's like what it is, who plays Nai Nai, plays Billy's grandmother. She is back in China and she is dying from a terminal disease. They decide not to tell her. Apparently, this is somewhat custom in China to sometimes, not always, but sometimes not tell someone that they're dying so they're able to actually enjoy their life as opposed to them kind of having to have the suffering. One of her sons kind of talks about how one of the best things you can do is to absorb that suffering yourself so that she does not have to do it while dying as well. Well, Awkwafina plays Billy, who is, she wants to be a writer. She's kind of lived in America her entire life, but she loves her Nai Nai, so she kind of surprises her family by going back to visit her for a wedding. They all claim that they're all visiting just for this wedding, though the couple itself is not particularly that central to the family, but it's actually to be able to come and say goodbye to her. And so this is, in many ways, I've not seen Lulu Wang's previous film. Have you?
I have not, no.
Okay, so this is, in many ways, it is a comedy, but kind of a bittersweet comedy, in that like Awkwafina is known for a comedy and she has some funny moments in this, but this is a much more kind of toned down role. And it really is about, in a lot of ways, one of the best things that The Farewell does is it explores the idea of someone like Billy, who has been, is very Americanized and still loves and feels like a clear connection to her home back in China and certainly to her family, but also doesn't understand some of the customs and doesn't understand some of the differing viewpoints and differing mindsets involving their family. So that, I would say that that stuff works really, really well. The grandmother is played extremely well. She's very funny, but she's never too cute. I feel like she is always, there's kind of a smart, fun edge to her. I would also say that Lulu Wang she has a really great eye. There's a really great scene involving a photo opportunity for the couple that's getting married, where she kind of like talks, like, I think it's framed very well. And she kind of, you get a sense of how the grandmother and Billy have like a bit of a separate kind of closer connection than maybe the rest of the family does. I think this movie is very charming. It's very well done. I think it's very relatable to anyone who has moved away from the place where the rest of their family is, and kind of the obligations that you have to those people, but also the desire to be able to make your own kind of life. I think Awkwafina is very good in that role. I think it works out pretty well. I would say on the whole, however, I did like this movie. I find some of the praise for it maybe a little overdone, in that I find this more of a good crowd pleaser than, I think there's a level of depth to it that it doesn't quite dig that deeply on it. I think it's a better family drama than it is a character study, which I was to say, I think Awkwafina plays this character very well. I don't think there's a lot to her. I think that I wish that character had a little bit more depth going on, had a little bit more story going on. I wish there was a little bit more involvement with the mother in that way. But, you know, this is a very charming, excuse me, the grandmother in that way. I would actually argue the mother in this movie is actually probably the most interesting character, and is generally the daughter-in-law of the dying woman. I would argue she is actually the most fascinating character in the movie, and the movie kind of gives her a little bit of short shrift. I think the movie is good. I think it is funny. I do think that I will be careful of spoilers. It ends in a couple of ways. One I think is really, really good. One maybe a little bit less so. I think this is very solid and very enjoyable, but not quite deserving of some of the over-the-top praise that you've seen.
So I saw this at Sundance, where it premiered and got, you know, rave reviews, and people really, really loved it. And my feeling at that time was that I thought it was solid and lovely, and very gentle. And I thought it worked really well, but I didn't think it was amazing. And I actually watched it again this week, since I knew we were going to be talking about it. And I feel the same. I still feel that way. I think it's really lovely. And I think it's really, it is, I would say there may be four or five great performances in this, the people that you've mentioned. Diana Lynn plays Billy's mom, and I think she's really tremendous. And I actually like the amount that the mom, that Billy's mom is in it, because it suggests an outsider's perspective on this family. And it's also kind of a nice reminder that, you know, your parents are part of your family and you think of them all as part of the same group of human beings. But for the wife or the husband, it might be their other family and not, in fact, the family that they know as well. And I think that Billy's mom is really great in terms of showing a resentment that has always been there for her. I think that's really, really well done. And I think Zima, who plays her dad, is also really good. He's a character actor. He's been in a ton of stuff. Like, he was in Arrival and Rush Hour and a bunch of different things.
But I feel like he's played the Chinese premier many times in his career.
I feel like he is like, who is the dignitary who gets kidnapped or is imperiled? I feel like that is the role that he often.
He was on 24. I think he was the head. Yeah, he was on 24. If you remember the head of whoever represented China on 24, it was him. And he was, for the record, that 24 is very silly, but there was a gravitas he clearly had in that role. I think he has it here too.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of across the board. It's really well acted, and it's based on a true story. It originated, Lulu Wang did this on This American Life, and it's drawn from her own experience. This is a fictionalized version of it. But nonetheless, it is drawn from what she knows. And this is not a spoiler that her grandmother in real life, she had a terminal illness and It is. I asked a few people who I know who are Chinese. Like I said, how prevalent is this? And apparently it is. It's not like a law of any kind, but it is a common enough thing that people will, I think people of Chinese heritage will understand that this is a thing that is done, which opens up a bunch of other questions we probably can't get into. But for me, the thing that doesn't, that keeps it from being great or as amazing as a lot of people feel like it is there is a built-in repetition in the movie that is part of its design. What happens over and over again is that because Billy was born in China but moved to the U.S., to New York, at a relatively young age, she doesn't understand this tradition. She wants to tell her grandmother. And she keeps asking family members who are not her grandmother, why can't she tell her? And isn't it wrong not to tell her? And different people in the family say, no, you can't do it. This is the reason why. This is the reason why. This is the reason why. The farewell's like dramatic tension is entirely built in the fact that we as an audience and the characters in the movie, except for the grandma, know what is going on and the grandma does not. And while I appreciate what is supposed to be ironic and even frustrating about that situation, especially for Billy, it does create a repetitiousness in the story that I don't think the movie entirely can overcome. That's part of the, again, the design of the movie is that the character is supposed to be like beating her head against a wall going, this is stupid. Why are we doing this? And people are basically saying, because this is the way we do things. I do think that The Farewell does a really good job of saying, not just this idea of Billy not understanding her heritage, but this idea of East versus West, this idea that Americans think too much about themselves as opposed to the family or a more kind of collective unit. And some of that debate is really kind of interesting in this movie. It does bring up to mind the question, should you not tell people in this situation because it is better for you to hold on to that burden rather than to have that person who is dying, don't give it to them. You are actually okay. You should hold on to it for them. I think that's really interesting and a lot of kind of thought-provoking stuff. I just think that, unfortunately, that is a thin kind of dramatic through line for the movie. And I think it creates a lot of great gentle ironies, but it doesn't destroy me in the way that I think it does other people. Now, the question that comes to mind while watching the movie, since I've watched it twice now, is, and again, I don't think this is a spoiler, because I think as you watch the movie, this comes to mind. Does the grandma, in fact, know what's going on? And I would, and I've had conversations with people about this, about when do they think the grandma knows? Does the grandma ever know? My question as a as an American who doesn't understand this tradition or did not grow up with this tradition is, if it is so ingrained or a part of the culture, if you are an older person and your whole family comes to visit you, does that not, in fact, make you think, oh, no,
I'm dying.
And this adds another interesting question to the movie, which is that does the grandmother, in fact, know? And if she does, in fact, know, is she also playing a role? That she is not saying, I know why you're here. But she is, in fact, playing a role like they are playing a role. I think all of that is really kind of lovely and interesting. But it's something that I think about more than I necessarily felt while watching the movie. Talking about this film in some ways is actually a deeper, richer experience than watching it, which again, like you're saying, Will, I don't want to diminish the movie because I do think it's strong. But there is something about the gentleness and the repetition of its storyline that kept it from being the home run. I kind of guess I sort of wanted it to be. I'm kind of, again, this is kind of in my wheelhouse. This is the type of movie, like while watching, I thought of one of my all-time favorite films, Yi Yi, which is a different type of story, but it's about a family that's dysfunctional. And you spend 3 hours with that family. This family you spend about 95 minutes with. And you get more of a slender snapshot than necessarily a deep dive into this family. You get an idea of how this family is versus a novelistic kind of overview of all the characters. So I'm kind of in the same place that you are about this movie, Will. I think it is good, and I think it is strong. And if anybody is wondering if they should see it, the answer is definitely yes. It will not be on my top 10 list at the end of the year, it will be on other people's, I'm fairly certain. This is a movie I have a lot of respect for, but I didn't love it as much as I kind of wished I'd had.
Am I wrong? Do you think that Billy's not quite interesting enough? I think she's not quite, I think she's played well, and I think that her experience is certainly very relatable. I'm just not sure I understand her much further than her experience, right? Like, I'm not sure that character's a lot more going on other than that pull between where her family is from, where she's from, and where she lives.
I think what is interesting and also kind of limiting about the movie is clearly Billy is supposed to be the Lulu Wong stand-in. And I think that sometimes, again, I haven't seen her first film, but there's always a bit of a challenge when her first film was called Posthumous, by the way, in case anybody is wanting to seek that out. But I think there's always a bit of a challenge when you, in some ways, cast yourself as the main character, because in some ways that character is more of an observer of a situation as opposed to a strongly drawn. It's almost like you know yourself so well that it's maybe harder to create that character because you know yourself so well that you don't necessarily flesh it out, whereas some of the other characters in the movie maybe are a little more fleshed out. But I also think it is perhaps a commentary on that character that, you know, what we know about her is she's trying to get this fellowship. She does not get the fellowship. She's in her mid-20s, something like that, you know, and she's trying to start a life. Like, she's trying to learn how to be a grown-up in New York, which is challenging for lots of people in their 20s. And so in some ways, she is not fully formed yet. And there's also, I think, because of what she hears when she goes back to China, this implication of, well, the reason why you're not as successful or whatever is you haven't settled down. You haven't, you know, you're so selfish and so Americanized that you've forgotten your heritage, and that's why you're kind of struggling in your life. To me, it reminds me of some of my friends, women specifically, who were in their 20s who didn't have a boyfriend or a husband yet. And there's this idea of like, oh, it's so sad. You know, you're trying to do all these, you have all these ambitions, but you know, you really just haven't found someone yet. There's almost this this conservative notion of settle down, marry. That's how you know you're successful. Her grandmother keeps telling her, oh, you're so pretty. I can't believe you're not married yet. You know, this kind of thing. But all of that being said, it is, I think, a slight problem with the movie that she is not, the arc that she goes on is not, there's not a large path. There's not a long trajectory in terms of where that character goes in this movie. I think that's a little bit of a limitation.
Yeah, but I mean, again, it feels weird. I'll put it this way. If we saw this movie, and this is why we do our best to not be too responding to what everyone else is talking about, because I think if we just seen this movie without having any idea how anyone was reacting to it, I think we probably would have sounded more positive than we are now. And I think it's because it has been so kind of elevated. And I listen, this is a movie that it did very well this weekend in limited release. This is a movie that you cheer for. Like, this is absolutely a movie that you cheer for. It has a big heart and it's smart. And it really, she's got a great eye. she's clearly a good director. I just feel like I just wanted to be a little bit thicker, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I am a big fan of small movies that end up being deep and profound. And this movie, I feel like, is more small. It feels like a short story, and it is delicate in that way, but it doesn't necessarily expand in my mind the more I think of it. I will say this, my good friend Justin Chang wrote a really terrific review of this in the LA Times. And while I'm not with him in terms of the enthusiasm of his take on the movie, I think he gets it exactly right in terms of making the case for this film and why it's so good. So if you were listening to the two of us, you're like, well, you might check out his review, because it also, I think, sort of speaks to a lot of what is kind of going on under the surface of this film.
Yeah, there are times I wonder if we should just make this podcast a lot of times reading Justin Chang reviews.
Well, listen, no human being can go wrong reading his fabulous writing week in and week out. Absolutely not.
All right, so what'd you give it?
I give it a high B.
Yeah, I give it a B as well. Where's my bell? Where's my bell, Kristen? Oh, I lost my... There it is. There's the bell of agreement. The bell of agreement.
Especially with the summer that we've had, and we've talked about it a little bit, where there hasn't been a lot of really good stuff. You know, this is, as you said, the stuff that you cheer for partly because original filmmaker, written, directed by her. You know, it is not a Marvel movie. It is not a studio film. Put it this way, you and I are in the luxurious position of being able to see these things and not love them, even though they're valuable. I think for a lot of people, this could save their summer, honestly, because a lot of other people would be like, Jesus, everything has been really terrible this summer. Is there anything I can see? This is a limited release right now. It is going to expand. Yeah. A24 will do its job. We have reservations. It's worth, absolutely worth seeing.
It is a crowd pleaser, and if you see it, you will be pleased. All right, now we're going to go to our second movie. I'm just going to ask Grierson about it, but first he's going to give us a little plot description. That movie is the one I avoided like the plague, Stuber.
Please be a five-star ride.
Hey! Uber?
Yeah. Be cool, be nice.
I'm Stu. How do you do?
Compton. I'm LAPD. Let's go.
What, do you have a more specific address?
Compton!
Yelling neighborhoods, that's not how Uber works.
Stuber, or colon, come back the farewell, all is forgiven, is directed by Michael Dowse, who a few years ago made Goon, which was good. You liked it better than I did, but I will still say it is a better version of what this movie is trying to do, which is to dissect and make fun of and spoof sort of macho tendencies within the confines of a macho type of movie. He did that with a sports movie, with a hockey movie. This is an action comedy in which Kumail Nanjiani, who will survive this, thank goodness, plays Stu, who works in like a big box sporting goods store during the day. And in the afternoons and evenings, he drives an Uber to make more money. His most recent ride is a cop named Vic, played by Dave Bautista. He has just had LASIK eye surgery. He can't drive. He can't see it very well. He needs someone to drive him around because he is on the track of a very dangerous drug dealer who killed his partner. And so they have to work together, Dave Bautista and Kumail Nanjiani. This movie is bad, Will. I will now take your questions.
So it is bad. Okay. So I have to say, I saw the trailer for this, and I have to admit, it didn't look terrible. Kumail Nanjiani and Dave Bautista, frankly, are both pretty funny people. Are they funny in this movie, or are they just desperately gasping for comedic air?
Nanjiani is a little funnier than Bautista, which would make sense because, you know, he's a stand-up comic, and Dave Bautista, you know, he's not unfunny. He's very funny in the Guardians of the Galaxy movie, but this is a movie where you have to pull what you can from the material, which is not much. The problem is, and I felt like you, this had, to me, like, this is collateral, the action comedy. That sounds great. Like, I would be really interested in seeing that. The problem is, this is a movie where it's like, you know, Stu is like a beta male wimp, and Vic is like a badass cop. So, like, they're, like, versions of masculinity are comedically opposed to one another. Let's see what happens. And so, basically, what happens is Vic keeps thinking that Stu is a big wimp, and Stu thinks Vic is a jerk. And that is the debate they have throughout most of the movie. And so, there's not much, the characters are so broadly drawn that there's not much room for them to actually be funny together, which is... With these types of, like, this is not a buddy cop movie. It's more like a mismatch, like, odd couple kind of pairing. And in those types of movies, the idea is the people don't like each other, but they'll eventually come to like each other. But it'll be fun to watch them bicker. I mean, that's a whole Midnight Run template, right? The problem with this movie is I just didn't like the two people. And I never got to a point where I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun to watch them put aside their differences and realize their sort of common bond. So... Nanjiani has funny moments, but the thing is itself not funny.
Okay, so I kind of want to get back to Nanjiani because I feel like, you know, he did the voice thing in the Men in Black International. I feel like I'm getting a sense that you like this about as much as you like that. Maybe a little bit, this a little bit more. Nanjiani, obviously, it was a big hit that he had last year. And it felt like he was like kind of primed to, you know, maybe like go to the next level as kind of a star. Is this setting him back? You say he's going to survive it, but this is kind of a couple of rough things in a row.
Yeah, I mean, I think what helped him in Men in Black International is it because you couldn't see him on screen and nobody actually saw that movie. That wasn't very damaging. What also doesn't help this movie is this was a Fox release that now Disney is putting out. Because Fox has been, you know, absorbed into Disney. And you can kind of tell that Disney just doesn't care all that much about this. So it's been kind of, feels like in some ways been kind of dumped. Though Nanjiani's been out there a decent amount, and so is Bautista. I think Nanjiani will be fine, because I think that he does not embarrass himself. And I think that there is so much goodwill in reserve for him as an actor and as a comic. This is not going to keep anybody from watching Silicon Valley's final season or whatever. People are, you know, I think people still just really like Nanjiani. And I think what has helped, to be perfectly honest, is that Nanjiani and Bautista have been so fun doing the press tour of this that people still like them. It's almost one of those situations where people feel like, well, the movie was bad, but, you know, movies can end up being bad. It just happens. But these guys are actually really fun, and they seem really fun together. So I think that he is, I mean, he's writing other stuff with his wife, Emily V. Gordon. I think he is going to be completely fine. This is not going to be a thing that, like, derails him. He's going to be okay.
So my last question before you get to the grade, did I do make a wise decision in my life in choosing not to see this out of almost protest?
When I am on my deathbed many years from now, Will, I will say, and you come to see me, tears in your eyes as you hold my hand. And I hope you're writing this down. I'm expecting this out of you. I will look at you.
I am not touching you. I don't care how much you're dying. I'm not touching you.
Wow. That my last wish. I might think, God, this is horrible. I take it back. There'll be two things I will think of you illly about. The first one is that. And the second one is like, I had seen this a couple of weeks ago as I reviewed it for Street International, but to be stabbed in the back and betrayed in this way that you left me to die on the side of the road watching this movie. Also, it's worth pointing out, this is an action comedy. It is rated R. The action also isn't good in it. And there's also a lot of like, oh, we're being so un-PC in our comedy because we're being edgy, and that stuff isn't funny either. I'm going to give a very quick shout out to a movie that's much better this weekend about like toxic masculinity and sort of like making fun of that, which is The Art of Self-Defense, which opened in limited release. It is not amazing, but it's good and it's smart and it's interesting. And Jesse Eisenberg is really fun, sort of subverting his own kind of on-screen persona as a wimp who gets picked on. Camille Nanjiani is also, I think, a fun wimp type personality who gets picked on. This is not the movie for him. It's bad. And I'm still mad at you that you did not. Actually, it's fine, because why put yourself through this? Well, there's no reason to see it. I forgive you. I don't forgive you for the not holding my hand part, but this I will forgive you for.
So what'd you give it?
Gave it a C-.
C-? Oh, so you liked it more than Men in Black International. There you
go. Yes, put that on the poster.
That was the dividing line. All right, now we're going to go to the second movie, the final new movie of the week that I saw that Grierson did not. So we'll see if it rises above the Stuber line, which I wonder if that should be like a thing, right? It's like a Stuber.
The Stuber line.
It's a Mendoza line. That movie is Crawl.
The state of Florida has issued a Category 5 hurricane warning. All residents must evacuate immediately. Grab your families, your loved ones, and get out.
Dad!
We won't be able to come for you.
Dad!
Crawl is directed by Alexandre Aja, who did the Last House on the Left, Is that correct?
He did,
Hills Has Eyes.
Yeah.
Hills Has Eyes.
He did High Tension, but we talked about on the
podcast. He's in High Tension, right? That's right. Thank you. Thank you. That's why I recognize that name. So this is right. He did not write this. He directed this. It stars, Kaya Scodelario. That sounds right. And Barry Pepper. Kaya, I'm going to call her Kaya because I don't want to mangle her name any more than I already have. We meet her in a, I would say, somewhat amusing wink. The movie starts. She is a swimmer. She's a swimmer for the University of Florida. The Gators. She is a swimmer for the University of Florida. It turns out that her father, Barry Pepper, drove her very, very hard as her coach growing up, but she's struggling. She's not really doing as well as she would like. But she still is very dedicated to what she does. She ends her meet and picks up her phone, and it is her sister, her older sister, who says, "Hey, have you heard from Dad?" Their father's divorced. "Have you heard from Dad? There's a big hurricane coming, and I haven't been able to get a hold of him. And you know how he is. He's one of those people that won't leave when there's a hurricane." Well, she, therefore, Kaya, or Haley, as she's played in the movie, we'll just call her Haley because that's the character's name. Haley drives to go try to find her father, goes into the house that they grew up in, that they no longer live in, and he is there. He is alive, but predisposed and unable to get out of the way of the hurricane, and therefore she has to both help him and evade a, as we see 10 minutes into the movie, as she's driving in toward the hurricane, there's a very ominous billboard, Grierson, and the billboard says, "Alligator compound, turn right 4 miles." Bad sign. Bad sign when there's a hurricane.
When do you get to the fireworks store?
Exactly. "Please disperse. Nothing to see here." So there are four. Basically what happens is alligators are coming, and she has to both save herself and her father while evading all of the alligators. Grierson, what kind of questions do you have about Crawl? For the record, by the way, I'm assuming this is based on a script by two, I believe, brothers, Michael Rasmussen and Sean Rasmussen. I guarantee you their script was called Crawl Space because the movie takes place entirely in a crawl space. And I guarantee you someone at some point said, "Let's just call it Crawl." And so they called it Crawl because there is some crawling done in this movie, but I'm going to bet it was originally called Crawl Space.
Well, alligators crawl, so... Right? So
then, yeah, they're mostly swimming.
That's not one of my three questions, by the way. I'm still holding on to my three questions. Yes. Yeah, I just love it because it sounds, when you say it, it sounds like Crawl, the movie from the 1980s. Like, oh, it's like a weird, it's like a weird reboot of that, but with more alligators and crawl spaces, apparently. Okay, so question number one. This movie is set in Florida. Wikipedia tells me that it was shot in Serbia. That's not my question. My question is, how much of a, you know, how Florida is, how much of that is incorporated into the humor of Crawl?
You know, one of the things, people like Crawl, you should know that. And I wish it had a little bit more of that humor, to be honest. Crawl is, I think it's pretty well constructed. It's not actually very funny. And it sounds like it should be funny, right? This sounds like a Sharknado, like killer alligators. And it feels like it's funny. There are not, that, like, the only real good joke is that she's a swimmer for the Florida Gators. That's really the kind of only good joke. There are not a lot of Florida main jokes. There's a what I will say, I made it sound like there's only two people in the movie. There are like seven. But there
are seven. Yeah, can you imagine walking out of a movie and being like, "Dude, do you think there's like two people? There's like seven."
There's like seven. I'm not counting the other swimmers in the first scene. Once she makes her way out there are like seven people. This is clearly a hugely budgeted movie. There's not a lot of big, it really takes place in one place. There's just a lot of water. And but I would say that the only real Florida part that you get is if you're wondering, wait, if there's two people trying to escape from the alligators, do I get to see the alligators kill anyone? Worry not, young listener. You do get to see alligators kill people because you do have the five other people show up just to be torn apart by alligators. And they are kind of what, like the one of them, three of them are trying to, in probably the one moment you're referring to in this kind of vein, they are in a boat and they are looting. So they attempt to pick up an ATM machine and put it in the boat. That sounds funnier than the movie plays it. Uh-huh. That should be funnier. It's not funnier when it feels like there should be some Breaking Bad-esque being, how do you open an ATM machine when you stole it humor that is not in there, unfortunately. The movie is actually not very funny and not very Florida funny in a way that I wish maybe it were a little bit more.
I feel like over the last several summers, not everyone, but a lot of them, you will have this kind of low budget man against nature kind of movie. I think of that Blake Lively shark movie from a few years ago. This same filmmaker did Piranha 3D from a few years ago. You had a lot of these things where it's like, even like the Meg falls into that. It's a little more big budget, obviously, but it's almost like this like cheeky, knowingly B movie kind of junky animals going to eat you movie. I am assuming the movie kind of leans into that, like it sort of knows that. You already mentioned it's not funny. Is that part of this movie? Does any of that work in terms of just being like a fun turn off your brain, watch the alligators wreck some shit?
I would say no, to be honest. This movie doesn't. I would say in the middle ground there, this is better than the Meg. I'll give it that. It's a lot more limber than the Meg. But I think the best thing that Crawl has going for it is it's like 82 minutes. It says 87. I don't think this thing is really short. It gets in, it tells a story, and it leaves. And that is to its credit. But I would say because it's so bare bones, a lot of that thing that you might want, that Piranha, I would say Piranha 3D curved too far in this direction. The did of Christopher Lloyd. And so that was, I will give credit for that. It went a little bit too goofy. Whereas the Meg was probably a little bit the Meg. I wanted the Meg to be the movie that you're talking about, and it wasn't. Piranha 3D was maybe too much of that movie. This movie is in the middle there. It is better. It's better constructed. It's better acted. I would say that both of them are very good. That Kaya Scodelario, or whatever, however you say her name, she has very incredibly expressive eyes that work out very well in a lot of close-ups where she's looking to see if an alligator is about to attack her. She's well played. She's very strong, and I think that their relationship is kind of maybe not interesting, but you certainly believe their relationship, and I think that works out pretty well. It's still not. That if you're like, oh my gosh, it's the movie. It's like if you're thinking, hey, will I get like a Sharknado Jones out of this? You won't. It's much more straightforward than that. It is not. It's much more. It reminded me of what's the doggone it? What was the? I think it was a Blumhouse movie from a few years ago, where the lady there's a lady in the house and she just has to. And there's a murderer that comes into the house and tries to get her, and she has to get out of the house. And he's like got other women trapped in there. And I do you know what movie I'm talking about?
Gosh, I do not know.
Okay, well, it was actually. I'm sorry, I don't know the name of the movie. It was a surprise hit, and forgive me, I don't know it, but you know, I was watching baseball with my son all weekend. But it's a movie where it's well constructed and well done, and kind of a bottle episode of a show, but not like. That's kind of all that it is. This is not quite as good as that. It's just not. Funny. It's just not like, if you're looking like, oh my gosh, it's not The Shallows. Like, I think The Shallows is not really funny, but it like is aware. It's very self-aware of like, this is Blake Lively trying to fight off a shark movie. This movie is a little bit more emotionally invested and a little bit more tightly constructed, which makes it a better movie, but I would also argue makes it a little less fun.
Was that The Gallows you were thinking of?
The Gallows. I mean, I'll look it up.
Along those lines, as you mentioned, this movie's gotten actually some decent reviews.
That's it. The Gallows. The Gallows.
This movie has not gotten glowing reviews. It hasn't been, you know, it's not compared to The Farewell or something like that. But it's gotten what I would say is mostly, hey, you know what? This is actually kind of fun. And I feel like it speaks to, especially this point in summer movie season, where people are just kind of looking for something that is unpretentious, not so ambitious, not trying to be the next 2.5 hour, 4-quadrant summer blockbuster, tentpole kind of thing. Is there any pleasure in it simply being that? Can you enjoy this movie on its own terms, or is this something that when it shows up on an airplane in 4 months, people would just be like, oh my God, why did I like that? Why did I give that a good review? I mean, is there anything remotely redeeming about this?
It's it's well acted, and I do think it's pretty well constructed. It's just, I think, overpraise this at your own peril. Like, if you are really, really into this, I think you might be desperate, to be honest. I think you might be desperate. It's fine. It's perfectly fine. It doesn't rise. Its screenplay feels very constructed. Like, oh, I see this thing in the first 5 minutes of their relationship. I'm going to bet this comes up again at the climax. Like, it really is. You can see the seams of its construction in a way that I expect more of, for as much as people like this and as much fun and as much as they're kind of into it. I think it's a movie that sounds like, oh my gosh, there's two people alone in a house and there are alligators everywhere and they have to escape. It sounds more fun than it maybe it actually is.
I was just realizing, like, Snakes on a Plane still feels like the template for this type of thing. Like, that is it. When are they going to get to the fireworks factory? I know someone is listening right now wanting to get that Poochie reference right. I hear you. I am here for you. Will, what did you give Crawl?
I give it a C+. I couldn't quite get there. It's fine. It's well done. I just didn't quite fight goofy enough to make it worth my... it's fine. It's better. It certainly sounds like I made the right decision by seeing it instead of Stuber.
Well, it's definitely got better reviews than Stuber, put it that way. Yeah, I'm surprised this did not screen in advance, and that usually means this thing is a total disaster area. But people, I think, were very excited to check it out, and the reviews have actually been pretty decent. I am surprised that Paramount just decided to punt and not even put out like a Wednesday night screen. I mean, they did that for Pet Sematary, the remake of that, and some other things. Like, I'm surprised that they just didn't even bother. But it did okay for a low-budget studio movie, but I'm not seeing this.
Yeah, it's not, I was a little, it just seems, I think people are just desperate. I think that's why they're overpraising it. And it is well acted. It is, I say it's disorienting to see Barry Pepper, who I feel like very recently was just the young yokel kid, now is like the grizzled dad. Such a reminder. We're all getting
I just wanted to think that it is his character from the Spike Lee movie, from 25th Hour. He has gone down to Florida now. His life has changed. He's turned his back on Wall Street, and now he's trapped in a house with alligators.
All right, so that was dutiful on both of our accounts.
Dutiful! exclamation mark.
All right, so now we're going to go to our reboot movie. I'd say the odds, I've not seen this movie, but if you've been like, well, they don't really sound enthused about any of these, maybe this will get us there. That movie is Poetry.
아무리 궁리를 해도 동거할 데는 없고 그래서 얘기하는 거예요. 굉장히 기분이 좋았고
Poetry premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in 2010, finally got released in the United States in 2011 through Kino Lorber, who do lots of great work with international cinema and art house stuff. This is the last film that Lee Chang-dong made before Burning, which came out last year and was number one on my list and number seven on Will's list last year. This movie is about a woman in her 60s named Miha, played by Yoon Jong-hee. And as we meet this character, she is not in some ways dissimilar from, I was thinking about this when I saw it, rewatched it this week. Will and I both had a lot of praise for the movie Diane, one of our top films of the first half of 2019. And in some ways, Diane and Miha are somewhat similar. This is a woman, a grandmother. She lives with her grandson, who seems kind of a dullard, I think is probably the nicest way of putting it. He's just kind of unexpressive. He just sort of sits around the house. He really doesn't care much for his grandmother one way or the other. She has kind of a small, quiet life, not much going on. She goes to the doctor, and she's going in for one reason, but she mentions that she has problems remembering things. And the doctors decide to just sort of take a look into that, and what we find out later is that she has Alzheimer's. This movie, though, is not about an older woman battling sort of a scary condition. It's about a woman who discovers that her grandson, who is a dullard, is actually a rapist. One of the kids in her grandson's school has committed suicide by jumping off a bridge and drowning in the river below. And what comes out is that that young girl was being bullied by several of her classmates, including this grandson. And not just being bullied, but was raped by a few of them. The school wants to keep it quiet because they don't want this type of thing getting out for reasons you might imagine. And the other parents of the other boys also don't want this getting out for reasons you might imagine. So all of them meet, including Miha, to talk about what to do. And what they have discovered is that this young girl who has committed suicide, her mother is willing to take a cash settlement to keep the whole thing quiet. But there are some complications, and those may involve Miha getting involved. I saw Poetry when it came out in 2011. And at that point, I was still kind of in the camp of people who really admired Lee Chang-dong's work. I had seen Secret Sunshine and also Poetry, but didn't necessarily wasn't rapturous about him. Burning for me was the movie that put me over the top in terms of thinking that he is an incredible filmmaker. So I was actually really curious to watch Poetry again this time. This movie, actually, this performance actually won Best Actress for us for the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, which I remember so vividly at the time when we picked that as our winner for Best Actress. We got some pushback from other people who should be critics and should know better, from like, why are they picking such weird movies that nobody's heard of? Because it was the best performance of the year? I don't know. That might be a reason. I'm still kind of bitter about that, apparently. This movie I still don't think is as great as Burning. But the ability to kind of go back and rewatch this, I found really kind of rewarding in a lot of ways, partly because this movie is all about rhythm and tone and pacing and being with a character. This is a character study. If we talked about in The Farewell that main character, Billy, isn't necessarily well drawn, I would argue that Miha in this movie is left opaque somewhat, and that the fun of the movie is to try to connect those dots. And Lee Chang-dong sort of invites you to connect those dots. We know that she has Alzheimer's. We know that she is struggling to find something more in her life. She takes a poetry class, is where the movie gets its name from. And she's never really written poetry, but she just has this desire to try to write and express something within her. I think also to the movie's credit, this is not a movie where, she does not learn the mysteries of life by going to a poetry class and the poetry teacher explaining things, and then she writes poetry that unlocks this voice. It's not cliched in that way. The movie's a lot of mysteries, frankly. It's about a person who maybe has never had a very happy life, but has just kind of learned to roll with it, who discovers that she has a grandson who is a monster, and trying to figure out what she is going to do about that, especially when the monster doesn't seem to care one way or another. It's actually funny to rewatch this movie after seeing Burning, because this thing that this kid has in common with Steven Yeun's character is they both seem incredibly passive about the whole damn thing, which makes it much, much, much more upsetting. By the way, when she goes to another character's location and there's a greenhouse there, boy, that put a spasm down the back of my neck. Poetry is how I felt about when I saw it in 2011. I think it is really good. I think it is really involving. I think it's really thought-provoking. I don't love this movie, but yet a reboot requester sort of mentioned that it sort of devastates them. It doesn't devastate me, but I will say that where it ends up is really kind of quiet. And the more that I thought about it, especially having the time to see that again after all these years, it hits its landing. It does what it's supposed to do. And you realize it's where Lee Chang-dong was sort of always driving towards. If other people like this movie more than me, more power to them, because I think clearly Lee Chang-dong is kind of in his own class in terms of the types of movies that he makes. Yeah, Poetry is really good. It's not to me to the level of his absolute best work.
Yeah, I think I like it more than you do. And a lot of it does come down to that ending. It's certainly absorbing the whole way. One of the things I like about him, as a filmmaker. It's something of the things I liked about Burning too, is obviously he kind of gets in the reverie of these movies and they have this mystery to them, but they always seem grounded in the actual recognizable world, which is something I really kind of appreciate. There's a banality that's in both Burning and this. You make the comparison of those two characters, but there is a certain, you know, these are very thoughtful movies, and obviously it's a long time to make them, and then they're very about like kind of like these larger, almost existential sort of things and these kind of mysteries. But also there's like a lot of it really gets kind of caught up in the banal details sometimes in a way that I think is really kind of fascinating. That son in this is such like a blech shithead in every possible way, which is what makes him ultimately really dangerous, right? And makes to kind of see where she goes with it and to see where, you know, I don't think that she is always herself entirely clear of not only what's going on, but what she's going to do. I think there's a passivity to her that I think we realize where it's all leading. One of the things that's really exciting for me about the ending, and I don't want to give away too much of the ending, is it allows you, there are certain segments of what happens in the ending and certain specific things referenced that you go back and realize, oh, that's when that happened. That's what that's from. And like there's that moment where she pauses to think about writing a poem about something and then pops up later is really quite moving, and it really feels like this was a jigsaw puzzle that was being connected the whole time. But the movie never feels I'll put it this way. If this movie came out now with the way that the men in this movie talk to her and treat her, I feel like this would be it would certainly feel even more topical now than it does then. The way that they treat her is just like, what's wrong with you? Get with the program. They talk about like her like she's not in the room. Everything there's just expectations of what she's supposed to do. Never minding the horrific nature of what they're trying to cover up anyway. And never minding that it never even occurs to any of them that like, I don't know, maybe our kids should be punished for the horrible things that they've done. It never occurs to occurs to the school. It never seems to occur to the press. It never seems to occur to some of the local police. This feels like a movie that feels more urgent now. I didn't see it in 2010, so I don't know, but it certainly feels like, yeah, if this movie came out right now, I think that would dominate the conversation about this movie, and justifiably so. So to see it here, I found it, I don't know if this movie was enraging in 2010, but it made me very angry in a lot of ways that I wasn't really expecting. But I like that, you know, she's still consistently her, you know, she's very consistently, like, she doesn't know this. She doesn't feel like she is at the center of her own movie, I guess. She feels like she's still just trying to figure this out as well. So to have it land to where it does was really, really kind of moving. And I found myself too, a lot of times, there's a lot of references in this movie. Characters make a lot of references to what it must have been like when you were younger. You must have been a heartbreaker. Men must have been after you all the time. And there's a certain look that she gets that is not, like, she almost, like, occasionally she'll, like, try to giggle it away, just so they'll stop. But I feel like there's something to that character that is left in mystery in a really fascinating, satisfying way. That also the idea of her daughter, like, her daughter has, because we didn't really talk about how her daughter, the actual mother of the son, there was a divorce. She is, like, living away. She's being raised by the grandmother. She just kind of shows up toward the end. That's a whole other part of this story that we are not really privy to, but I am fascinated by. And I think that's one of the things that I love about this movie in the same way that I love Burning. And maybe even, I would argue, if you are, Burning has its mysteries, and I don't mean to say that Burning isn't accessible, because I think it is. I think this movie may actually be a little bit more straightforward in a way that I think may be satisfying for people I might recommend people watch this for, if you are really interested in Lee Chang Dong, I might recommend you watch this first and then watch Burning, because I do feel like this is, while there is mystery of this, there is also, it is more kind of linearly straightforward in a way that keeps those mysteries, but also lands in a place that makes everything kind of lock and click into place. I would say I thought this was really great.
Actually. Yeah, it's interesting that you say that this, you think this movie is more accessible, because to me, Burning has more of a, it's easier to stick it in a genre and kind of know what it is, where this is more of, like, to me, a character piece, which is sometimes a harder sell, I feel like, for other people. Hey, if people want to watch either one, that's fine. I prefer Burning. I prefer Secret Sunshine. I think you are right. I think what is especially strong in this movie is this idea of the terrible thing. It's in some weird ways actually made me think, it's less overt, but it made me think of The Sweet Hereafter. The idea of a terrible thing has occurred and how you rationalize and compartmentalize that. The Ian Holm character specifically in Sweet Hereafter, this idea of a terrible thing has occurred, but seriously, what are we going to do about this? And that there's a business of doing things to take care of a problem that both of these movies have. And that is, I think, what sort of powers what is a pretty gentle movie in poetry. This idea of, this is not a plot-driven thing. This is not a thing where she has to go and talk to the different parents and or talk to the mother of the child and make this thing work. That stuff's all happening in the periphery. But you don't forget that that's kind of what the whole movie's about. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get this confused. I think this movie is really good. I just don't think it's as strong. I think what I like, or what kind of stays with me in terms of the film, is this kind of sense of there is a victim, there is someone who has died, and that person intentionally, because it's part of Lee Chang Dong's design, he is pushing that character to the side so that you forget them. But the movie, and not to reveal where it goes, is about remembering. It's about remembering the person who is not there. What is interesting is that there are essentially two female characters in the movie. One of them is dead as a child, and the other one is the 66-year-old woman. And I, while watching it this time, I was thinking, you know, one of the criticisms I would hear from people about Burning is that of those three main characters in Burning, the female character is the least well-drawn. Or even worse, people saying, yeah, the movie doesn't seem to even care about that character. And my argument was, no. I think he knows what he's doing in terms of what he is saying about that female character. By putting her to the side, it is almost as if these guys are sort of erasing her to a certain extent. That's even truer, I think, in this movie. This idea of, as you put it so well, they're all dads, and she's the only mom who's there when they have those meetings. And it's not just the fact that she's a woman, she's also older than them. There's something that's also kind of like ageist kind of going on in this movie in terms of how they...
And she's poorer. Don't forget that, too.
She is poor. And this is like a relatively like small town. I don't know South Korea geography super well, but the impression I got, this is a small town. This is like a small town community where this thing has occurred. This is not in Seoul where this is happening. And yes, she is not doing nearly as well as the rest of them, because one of the things that happens is that she doesn't have the money to pay her part of the payoff, essentially. And she needs help in terms of doing her share. We haven't even talked about her what she does for money in this movie, which is also kind of this interesting idea, because it's the only older character than her in the movie, and the way that he is in some ways suggests where her future lies in certain kind of horrible ways, not in terms of the way that he acts, but in terms of his just deterioration. But I actually kind of like the idea that the women in this movie are the two most important characters, but in some ways they're both kind of being marginalized. What I like about the ending, not to spoil anything, is that it connects the two characters. It finds a way to connect in their own way what they've been going through in a way that does not feel patronizing. You brought up the point, if this movie came out now, how would people feel? I would be curious if people feel like, oh, it's a little too on the nose in terms of like Time's Up and Me Too and like that. In some ways, this movie's great blessing is that it came out long before that, but it's still speaking to the things that I think a lot of people are kind of wrestling with right now.
Yeah, I do. This movie kind of got me a little bit.
I'm thrilled to hear that. I think that's right. I have no qualm with anybody who is a big fan of this movie. It doesn't fully deeply as connect, but I'm thrilled. I'm glad that you liked it so much.
Yeah, I need to see Secret Sunshine now because this thing is really good. So, all right, so go see it. What did you watch? Did you watch this on Netflix? On Netflix disc? Because I couldn't find it on actual – it's not on iTunes.
I actually still have my screener from all those years ago. Wow. I hold on to certain things.
Hoarder.
Yes. There are certain things that are – I think I may want to revisit this. I don't know when or why or what the circumstances were. And when we talked about this, I'm like, I think I still have that. So I was very glad
to
pop that open. Yes.
Yeah, this movie's really good. I was kind of really surprised how much this movie kind of got to me a little bit, and the ending is just it's where it was going.
It's really nicely done.
So that's that's poetry. Really good. Thank you for that recommendation. I will say I was more wrecked by this, I think, than Grierson was. So because I have a warmer heart.
Remember it, ladies and gentlemen. He would not hold my hand on my deathbed.
All right, so that's our show this week. We have one new movie next week and two reboots, so we have not forgot you, reboot folk. The new movie is The Lion King. Are we doing? Oh, I'm sorry. That's The Lion King. The Lion King, directed by Jon Favreau. You may know him as Happy from the Marvel Cinematic
Universe. I can't believe they
let
him direct a movie after being like the character in the Marvel movie, but I guess.
He's so hapless in those movies.
Yeah.
I don't actually think he's great in the Marvel University movies. I feel like he's not enough of a, I don't know if he's great. Anyway,
I think he started off kind of enjoyable and now he's like in them. And it's funny, like an Endgame and even like in Spider-Man Far From Home, it's like, no, you have to carry like a lot of emotional payload in these things.
So this is The Lion King. He directed this. He's not actually in it. It is this is a thing that's happening a lot recently. There's some live action movies of anime, live versions of anime.
It stars actual animals.
Actual animals. Voiced by all sorts of great actors. I will say I, like a lot of people, my eyeballs like kicked back in my head and did pinwheels a little bit when I saw that cast photo of The Lion King, of everyone that's in this, just to be like, wow, it's just weird that Donald Glover, Beyonce, Billy Eichner, and John Oliver are in the same room.
It's like, it's a community reunion plus Beyonce. it's a community confusing movie of your dreams. Beyonce is also in it.
Very convenient. Yeah. Yes. So that's The Lion King. I feel like I'm curious of all of these movies, what do you think the best one is? You've seen Lion King, I haven't seen it yet. So not counting Lion King, but of this new trend, what do you think the best one has been so far?
Oh God, they're all so great. It's hard to narrow it down. Honestly, Beauty and the Beast. I mean, it's funny. I guess Beauty and the Beast.
I think it's probably Jungle Book. I'm not crazy about Jungle Book as much as a lot of people are, but I think it's still probably Jungle
Book. Yeah, I had problems with Jungle Book. I was like, I know people like Pete's Dragon. I thought it was just kind of so. People don't think. It's funny that people don't think of Pete's
Dragon. It's probably Pete's Dragon. It's probably Pete's Dragon.
Well, it's funny that people don't think about Pete's Dragon in this context, right? People were mentioning Cinderella, and it's like, oh, right, I guess that's part of it.
But I guess the thing is, though, is that like Pete's Dragon feels like an actual like reimagining of it.
Yes.
Whereas a lot of these have felt like a recital of it.
Yeah, like a Xerox copy of it. I mean, Beauty and the Beast I actually thought was okay. But yeah, none of these are like, oh my God, thank goodness they did this.
Well, we'll see if The Lion King meets that requirement. Then we have two reboot movies. The first reboot movie is 1987's The Princess Bride, directed by Rob Reiner, screenplay by no one knows anything, William Goldman, based off of his book, I believe. Yeah, I think it's based on his book. Starring Cary Elwes, Mandy Patinkin, Chris Sarandon, Christopher Guest. What a cast. Wallace Shawn, Andre the Giant, Peter Falk, Fred Savage, Robin Wright, and of course Robin Wright, and also Billy Crystal, and there are a lot of makeup. I haven't seen the. I think Princess Bride. I think I've talked this before, Gerson. There are certain movies that I just saw so many times in my childhood that, and then didn't see for like 20 years. That it is incredibly disorienting to watch them. Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Superman 2, Clue. There's just a, like there's like certain movies. The Princess Bride is one of those movies. I haven't watched it in a long time, but I guarantee you, watching it, I will be like a 13 year old kid again.
And to me, what's amazing is that I somehow never saw Princess Bride in my childhood. I never saw it. I did not see it for the first time until college. When people were like, "You've never seen it?" I'm like, "Yeah." I just somehow it completely missed me. So I don't have the same like childhood attachment to it. And I haven't seen it in its entirety since. Oh boy. A long time. So I'd be really curious. This is such a beloved movie, I feel like, for a certain generation of moviegoers. I am fearful if we do not like this movie enough that we are going to get angry tweets and emails from people. But bring them on, I say.
And to be fair, like, my childhood attachment, like, I wouldn't say that, like, I love Clue. Like, that's just the best movie. It's just that we had, like, six movies.
Right. As you have written about in terms of Clue.
Yes,
exactly. No, I remember you saying many times that Princess Bride and Clue are the reason why you got into movies in the first place. That they are the reason why you are still watching movies today. Those two films. Mm-hmm.
It's true. It's true. That sounds exactly right. That sounds like me.
Yes.
And then our final reboot movie is 2005's Cachet, or Hidden, as it was known in some places. Written and directed by... Enfant Terrible, Michael Haneke.
Wait, he's too old to be considered that, right? Like, that's, you have to be like
12. In 2005? How old was he in 2005? He was probably young and obnoxious in 2005. He was 63.
I was going to say, check your dates.
He's just kind of he's a rock on tour.
He's not that either. I don't think that counts. Don't you have to be a rock on tour? You have to be like a, you know, like a, you know, you're like a go-go type of guy.
He likes to mess with your shit.
That's more accurate. Whatever the French term for that is, that's what he is.
Yeah. He is a stirrer of the merde. No, I mean, that's death. What's French for poop?
No, it's, yeah, I think you're right.
Is it merde?
I think that's correct.
I thought it was death. Yes. Merde. Yes, I don't know. Who cares? Anyway, the point is...
You're selling this movie. Put it that way. You're doing a great job.
It's Michael Haneke. It's not Funny Games or either one of his Funny Games movies, but certainly seems of that.
Have you
realm.
Seen this?
I've never seen it.
Have you seen this?
I've literally never seen it.
Well, it's hilarious, let me tell you.
I have to tell you, I hate the Funny Games movies, so we'll see, right? But I do kind of hate the Funny Games movies. You should know that.
But you like them more, right? You like them more, right?
I liked Amore. Yeah. I liked The White Ribbon.
Yeah.
And The White Ribbon was good. Wait, is Amore really his last movie?
No, he did Happy End.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, which I was a big fan of, and a lot of people hated at Cam.
Oh, Piano Teacher was good.
Yeah.
That movie was good.
Yeah, but, yeah, spoiler alert, this is not like Amore very much. It's more like the other ones. So, yeah.
All right, we'll see how that goes. All right, so that's Cachet. So we're going to be discussing The Loin King, The Princess Bride.
Don't look that up on Pornhub. I'm sure there's like 1,000 Loin King.
The King of the
King
Loins.
King of the Loins, yeah.
And Michael Haneke's Cachet. Grierson, good show. Thank you for dealing. I was a little, I feel like I was low energy the night. The weekend wore me out and all the Trump shit. It just feels
don't
like such a
ever
the
use
time
low
sometimes.
Energy because of that fucking guy. It's one of those things like I never use low energy just because of Trump.
I know. It's the same way when someone says fake news, even when they're joking, like don't do that.
I know. That's like when people refer to it as the interwebs because they think they're being funny. It's not funny. Don't do that. No, I'm very glad that we got to talk about Farewell and poetry because it made up for you having to see Crawl and me having to see Stuber.
Yes, exactly. All right, Gerson, have a great week. We will be back next week to discuss all of those movies.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works because of us. And should anyone say different? It wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of us.